KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's get a report on our weather from Cedric Hayes with the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Good morning, KPCW listeners. Here's today's forecast for your Friday afternoon for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Friday, we're looking at plenty of sunshine all across the region here. It's going to be an absolutely beautiful day across the area. In Park City, we're looking at those temperatures climbing into the lower 70s for high temperatures. In the Heber Valley, we're going to see lots of sunshine, temperatures climbing into the upper 70s for daytime highs. Now, keep in mind, the UV index is at 9. That's in the very high category, so you need that SPF 15 or greater, you could burn in less than 15 minutes. So you may want to make sure you take care of that so you can enjoy some of this nice weather. Now let's talk about the all-important weekend forecast. Your Saturday, expect plenty of sunshine across the region here. We're really going to start the day off with temperatures into the 40s, low to mid-40s across the area. But as we go throughout your Saturday afternoon, look for that sunshine to stick around. Highs will be in the mid-70s for us in Park City with high temperatures into the lower 80s in the Heber Valley. So it is going to get quite toasty, but it stays warm as we go throughout the rest of your weekend. Your Mother's Day will see partly cloudy skies. There is a slight chance of a few isolated pop-up showers in the higher elevations as we go throughout your Mother's Day. High temperatures in Park City should still climb into the lower 70s for highs, and high temperatures in the Heber Valley climbing into the upper 70s to near 80 degrees. So it should be an absolutely beautiful Mother's Day weekend. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. Hopefully the weather will cooperate. Just again, a slight chance of a pop-up shower or storm on your Sunday afternoon. As we head into next week, we start off with sunshine on your Monday, highs near 70 in Park City. Highs will be into the upper 70s in the Heber Valley. But as we go into your Tuesday, we've got a storm system approaching. It's going to be bringing a cold front with it, so we're going to see a good chance of showers and maybe even a couple of rumbles of thunder across the area. Park City highs will drop down into the low 60s for highs on your Tuesday. Highs only in the upper 60s in the Heber Valley. And by the time we get towards your Wednesday, scattered showers and rumbles of thunder. Highs only in the upper 40s in Park City and highs only in the mid-50s as you get towards the Heber Valley. Could even see a little bit of mountain snow as well. That's your latest forecast. As we go throughout the rest of your weekend from the ABC Forecast Center, I'm Cedric Haynes.
You're listening to the local news hour here on KPCW. Coming up, I'm going to be speaking with Pete Stoughton about the upcoming bike swap held by the Park City Mountain Bike Club. Then I'll be chatting with Park City Community Engagement Manager Linda Jaeger, Planning Director Rebecca Ward, and Senior Transportation Planner Connor Campobasso about the upcoming Spring Projects Open House. We're going to finish our hour by speaking with Trudy Brereton. She's the Prevention Coordinator at Wasatch Behavioral Health about underage drinking prevention. Stay tuned. An alleged road rage incident in Wasatch County Tuesday left one man with 11 staples in his head and another charged with a felony. KPCW's Christine Weller reports it's one in a string of violent road rage incidents that have occurred in the area.
19-year-old Blake Gabriel Meckham is facing a third-degree felony in connection with an alleged road rage-turned-altercation. The Utah Highway Patrol says it ended when another driver was knocked unconscious. In a statement to a state trooper, the alleged victim said the trouble began when Meckham cut him off on Highway 40, just before turning east onto State Route 189. The driver said he then pulled up next to Meckham at a traffic light and threw up his hands. He claims Meckham responded with obscene hand gestures and then sped off. According to the alleged victim, he continued to drive west, but purposely stayed behind Meckham to, quote, be safe. He said when Meckham pulled over, he pulled in behind him. Meckham told law enforcement he believed the other driver was, quote, chasing him and pulled over to allow him to pass. Both men then exited their vehicles and began arguing. The alleged victim said he asked Meckham what his problem was. Meckham then asked the man if he wanted to fight. Meckham told law enforcement the other driver tapped him on the chest, so he, quote, just hit him two, maybe three times, and it knocked him out, court records say. Meckham claims he acted in self-defense and only intended to defuse the situation, not knock the other driver out. The man said he doesn't remember ever touching Meckham. One witness told the highway patrol they saw the two drivers standing outside their vehicles in the rain and watched Meckham punch the other driver. The witness said he saw the driver, quote, lock up and fall straight back flat. The witness also said he saw Meckham get in his vehicle, then get back out to check on the other driver before leaving the scene. When a state trooper arrived, the other driver had regained consciousness. The trooper said there was, quote, a pool of blood and a large pool of vomit on the ground. Medical personnel transported the driver to Timpanogos Regional Medical Center in Orem. According to the probable cause statement, a cut on his head required 11 staples. Meckham is charged in 4th District Court with road rage assault with injury, a third-degree felony carrying a possible punishment of 5 years in prison and fines. He's also charged with a misdemeanor for driving on a denied license. Meckham was booked into jail, but released on the condition he show up to court and avoid contact with the other driver. The alleged road rage incident comes as a different high-profile road rage case makes its way through 4th District Court. Greg Kyle DeBurr was charged with felony obstruction of justice in December 2024 after he buried the gun he said he used to fatally shoot hideout resident Patrick Hayes. DeBurr claimed he fired in self-defense and was not charged in connection with Hayes' death. Another road rage incident occurred in Heber on April 20th. 43-year-old Heber resident Lauren Ray Russell is facing felony charges after allegedly accelerating toward a biker in his truck and breaking the man's leg. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Park City's Historic Preservation Board has turned down a proposal to reconstruct the dilapidated Centennial House at the top of Main Street. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports that the board expressed interest in a different design approach.
The Historic Preservation Board reviewed a proposal Wednesday to demolish and reconstruct the property at 176 Main Street using salvaged and replacement materials. The home, previously known as the Centennial House and the Durkin Boarding House, was built around 1900. Several board members expressed excitement at seeing a proposal for the property, which has been vacant for some time. Park City Chief Building Official Dave Thacker said the property was previously condemned and has a failing floor and roof.
That condemnation is not just related to livability at this point. It's also related to the structural integrity of the home.
Board member Dalton Gackle called reconstruction a last resort and questioned if there was any other viable path forward for the home.
I don't know that it's up for too much debate that there really isn't much integrity left.
Board Chair Douglas Stevens asked if there was a way to preserve more of the building in the process.
I'm not seeing a restoration in what's been presented to us tonight. In fact, I think I'm going to be more confused by this building being torn down and reconstructed. I'm not going to be able to tell what's old and what's new.
He said he worried about pushback from the community with the high visibility of the Old Town property. Along with Stevens, other board members requested additional information about the full potential of the home's restoration. They also asked the lead architect to redesign plans so the home resembles the early 1900s version rather than how it looked after renovations in the 1970s. Instead of voting down the project, the board continued discussions on the proposal to its meeting June 4th. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Bike Swap is happening this weekend at the film studio. Here to tell us about it is Pete Stoughton. Morning, Pete.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit about this. Who sponsors that bike swap and how long have you guys been doing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. The bike swap started actually many years ago with Young Riders, Julie Minahan and the Young Riders program. And if you remember back in the old days, it was over in the building behind like Blind Dog and so forth. And then slowly the transition as the mountain bike team grew, the Park City High School mountain bike team, she handed that over and we helped run that. And we have been doing it now, I believe, for 6 years. And we're over in the Utah Film Studios. And it's pretty large. We usually have about 1,000 items or more now.
And tell us a little bit about the Park City High School mountain bike team. How many riders do you have? Is it an official school-sponsored team?
Yeah. So the high school mountain bike team, which also includes our junior Devo program, which is 7th, 8th grade, is part of a larger organization called NICA, and there are 7,500 kids in the state. We're the largest state in the country and the largest in the world of mountain bikers. And so all of these kids compete in the fall. We start riding here in June, and so we're part of that league. We are a high school, not a USHAA sport, but we are a club at the high school. And high schoolers do get varsity letters and high school credit for participating, but it's not a sanctioned sport. We have about 230 kids on our team. It's a pretty large team here in Park City, one of the bigger ones in the state.
Wow. So now, are you the coach? Is that how this works?
it takes a whole village to make that team with that many. 230 riders. There's 100 coaches.
100 coaches.
Yeah. So we have a really specific and strict rules about how many coaches per how many riders we have. And so we have to have one coach for every 6 riders. And all of our coaches are parents or community members. It's really a volunteer-led organization. And I founded the team with a couple other folks back in 2011 and 12. Took a break and then was asked to be the head coach and director again. So I'm the head coach, but really it's like head wrangler.
Sounds like
to many extent.
And we're going to get to talk more about the bike swap in a minute, but I have one more question, which is how does competitive mountain biking work in terms of scoring?
Yeah, it's kind of almost the opposite of cross-country running. So, and that's also important because every kid scores points. So every rider, no matter what their ability and age is, they score points for the team. And so that's where it's slightly different than cross-country running. Like after the top 7 score, there's really no points. Every kid scores for the team and we get a cumulative total. But our top 16 point getters, they count for our total. And that can be, you know, we could have a freshman scoring points. We could have a junior scoring points. We could have a senior scoring points, all in different respective categories. So it's not just varsity. We've actually, when we won states 2 years ago, we actually had a freshman scoring points for the state championships.
And one more question on these lines. Are the points awarded for speed, or are there other criteria by which points are awarded?
I mean, I wish it was based on style and pizzazz because our team is pretty stylish and fun. it's really a great club, really great kids, and they just know how to have fun. They'll wear tutus while they race. So, if it was based on other than, like, placement, we would crush it.
So it is based on placement,
It is based on placement within the respective. So you can have a single-lap rider. So we have scholarship kids who are brand new to biking. They'll be in our scholarship, in our single lap group, and they'll be scoring points because they're doing a great job in their first ever season. So we have brand new riders all the way to folks who are racing on a national level.
Okay. Well, you mentioned, I think you said earlier that you're going to have something like 1,000 bikes this weekend.
Yeah. So we've already checked in 600 items. And a lot of those are bikes this year. We have more bikes than we've ever had. I started texting some friends in the community to get some more what we call A-frames bike racks to hold bikes because we've pretty much filled up all of our racks. And usually we don't do that till today. And today's our last drop-off day. So people can still drop off bikes. We'd love to have them drop off bikes or bike equipment today between 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock tonight. We'll close at 7 o'clock. We're going to get ourselves all organized, put bows and whistle, you know, bows and all the bells on everything. And then we'll open Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Big note on that is you have to go to the back of the Utah Film Studios. We've got a bunch of signs there to point at people where to go. And that's where we're going to open up. We have to use the big doors because it's a lot.
And obviously there's bikes. Do we see everything, mountain bikes, road bikes, even e-bikes? Do you have the whole range?
Anything that's got 2 wheels or a wheel, we'll even take unicycles. Someone did try to drop off a motorcycle, and I was like, well, I don't know if that's within our wheelhouse. But we have e-bikes. We've got about 15 e-bikes there right now. We've got tons of road bikes, tons of mountain bikes, all the different sizes, kid sizes, adult sizes, and then all the paraphernalia and equipment that goes accordingly, helmets, jerseys, you know, so forth and so on.
Do you get some racks?
Yeah. There's definitely, I would say, about a dozen racks in there. So a great place to find some killer deals. So.
Okay. And what are the hours that people can, if they're interested? We mentioned what it takes to drop stuff off. If people are interested in buying, you said it opens tomorrow morning. What are the hours this weekend?
Yeah. So Saturday, it's from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. And we have what this is kind of a tradition from the Young Riders program. We have a Saturday price, so you can come and shop and get the deals on Saturday, and then prices drop on Sunday. But there's no guarantee those bikes are still there. On Sunday we open at 11 o'clock and we close at 3 o'clock. So, and I know that's Mother's Day. That's why we start. Well, we generally start later so anybody can go ride and whatnot in the morning. Again, we're bikers. We love to ride. But more importantly, spend time with their mothers and say thank you. We did double check with a lot of our female coaches, like, is this okay? And they're like, yeah, we don't have a better choice. So they were fine with it. So,
Pete, how much of the sales price, if I come in and buy a bike tomorrow, how much of the sales price goes to the team?
Right. So 20% of the sales. So if someone sells a bike for $1,000 or someone buys a bike for $1,000, we get 20% of those sales. That covers, obviously just running the swap. And then we have a good amount of scholarship riders and program costs. This is kind of our biggest only fundraiser really of the year. And so this really helps offset and keep our program costs really, really low.
So the scholarships that you offer, do those help students who can't afford it get bicycles as well as participate in the program?
Yes. So we have 10 to 15 scholarship riders. We work really closely with the Park City Community Foundation. They're really fantastic to work with. And we get some new kids on bikes, and so we have some really awesome kids that are participating. And one of the things that we'll do is, and we'll tell people up front, we're like, hey, we as the team may buy your bike. And the reason for that is because we need to get a kid on a bike who this is a great opportunity. So it actually helps us in multiple ways. We'll buy bikes from people on day one, and we'll say, this is a good bike for one of our scholarship kids.
You probably should wait till Sunday so you can get it cheaper.
When we do that, we want to honor their original price. But usually, and it's really great. We live in an awesome community. Sometimes people will be like, no, just take it then. But we want to help out both ways, make it beneficial.
All right, Pete. Listeners want to learn more. Is there a website they can go to learn more about the team or the swap or both?
Yeah. So you can Google, if you want, Park City Mountain Bike Team, High School Mountain Bike Team, or you can even just Google Park City Bike Swap, and it's the first thing that comes up. So those would be your best ways to see and learn more.
All right. Thanks, Pete, and good luck with the swap this weekend.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there.
We'll be right back after this. The Park City Council is considering how best to recognize Pride Month in June. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports a new state law bans the display of Pride flags on government buildings.
The local nonprofit Summit Pride Foundation, which advocates for the LGBTQ+ community, is asking the Park City Council to show its support during Pride Month in two specific ways. One asks the city to place Pride banners on Main Street light poles, as it's historically done. The other would affix decals saying Ride with Pride to city buses, which was also done last year. The city council is scheduled to consider the request at its meeting May 15th. Utah House Bill 77, which was passed by state lawmakers earlier this year, took effect Wednesday. The legislation bars all public schools and other government buildings from flying any non-sanctioned flags, including rainbow flags, which are widely associated with LGBTQ+ pride. Rep. Trevor Lee, Republican of Layton, sponsored the bill and said the measure is about maintaining political neutrality in public spaces. Lee told KPCW Thursday that banners comply with the new law as they are not flags, but he said Park City's potential moves are an attempt to subvert House Bill 77, which imposes a $500 per day fine on violators. He said state lawmakers could consider prohibiting banners. Park City officials previously said they were exploring the legal ramifications of the new law. Summit Pride is planning its own strategy to push back on the flag ban. Board member Virginia Solomon said they invite residents and businesses to go to their website to sign up and receive a Pride flag.
What our plan is through this Raise the Flag initiative is to flood the Wasatch Back with rainbows. We invite, individuals at private residences, at businesses, at nonprofits to fly Pride flags so that you can't even notice that they aren't being flown on municipal property.
Park City has historically held a Pride flag raising ceremony at Miners Park in June, but there are no plans for such an event this year. Solomon said they were proud of Park City High School students who draped PC Hill in rainbow colors Wednesday morning.
We love to see kind of future leaders taking these leadership steps to make sure that they don't let the state silence them and their freedom of speech and their right to assert that they like exist and deserve to be celebrated.
In the hours before House Bill 77 became law, the Salt Lake City Council adopted an ordinance to create three new city flags mirroring its traditional Sago Lily flag. The three designs include the rainbow pride flag, the blue and pink transgender rights flag, and another celebrating the history of Juneteenth. Lee responded to Salt Lake City's move on X, writing, quote, "Does Salt Lake City really want to play these games? Good luck." Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Park City Municipal is going to host a Spring Projects open house on Tuesday, May 13th at the Park City Library. Here to give us a preview, we have Park City Community Engagement Manager Linda Jaeger, Planning Director Rebecca Ward, and Senior Transportation Planner Connor Campobasso. Good morning. Thanks for being here, guys.
Good morning, Roger.
So, Linda, I think you guys do this every year. Why is it important to hold a function like this?
Well, you know what? We've been doing this for almost 10 years, and we do it twice a year. And the idea is to gather all our departments that have projects and initiatives to share with the community into one event to make it really easy for our community members to come out and find out what's going on. It's sort of a one-stop shop. And they've been very successful, and we try to make them fun. It's a great opportunity to gather with your neighbors and friends and learn about what we're doing in the city.
Now, does it all happen inside the Santee, or do you walk around? How's it laid out?
That's a really great question, Roger. We love to do it outside. We started doing outside during COVID, and we said, let's keep going with this because it's really fun. We are prepared for weather, so I always keep an eye on what's happening. So right now, it's looking a little chilly on Tuesday. We'll make a call the day of, but we're all set to be inside. So if we're inside, we're up on the third floor, room 301, the community room, and the Santee. And then we have a couple of outdoor things set up that will still go on whether with cold weather or not. So we've got Public Works displaying some vehicles. We also have our police department bringing out their motorcycle and a squad car. And then we're doing a spring bike check. So we'll have that set up outside for kids.
Wow. All we need is the fire truck and it'll be a complete, you know, elementary school kids wonderland.
Right? Well, no fire truck. It's patrol car.
That's all we need.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Now, super fun.
Okay. So, Rebecca, I think that you end up being kind of the star of this thing. The general plan update is kind of an important feature. Tell us about it.
So the general plan project was initiated last year, and we're now in the final phase of community engagement. We're really excited to share with the community what we've heard through the engagement process, and we've heard that this is an incredible place to live, and there are a lot of things that we need to protect and preserve, and also that we need to proactively address some of the challenges. It was really clear from the statistically valid survey that 71% of respondents feel that traffic is the number one thing that we need to address, and then look at how our land use can help support a really comprehensive and convenient network of transit and transportation options.
We'll get to whine about transit with Connor in a minute, but I want to come back to sort of the concept of what is a general plan and how does that survey play into it?
Yeah, so the general plan is really a vision of where the community would like to be in the coming decades. And the general plan outlines the community's vision and goals and also specific strategies on things we can implement to plan for what's to come and also to protect what we have.
And how does it play into these specific projects that we hear about from time to time? We hear about maybe a gondola from the brewpub lot. We hear about, you know, what's going to happen with the 5 acres. Help me understand how those two interact.
Yeah, so the general plan will really build on some of the initiatives that are ongoing, like Recreate 248 and the feasibility study and project that's planned for the 5-acre site. There are a lot of really great plans and efforts that have been going on for several years with the Bonanza Park Small Area Plan, the 5-acre site feasibility study, and then some of the transportation improvements. And these become supplements to the general plan. The general plan is really the high-level overview. Yeah, really big picture. And there is a mention of gondolas in the recommendation, but it doesn't get into the specifics of where or when.
If I were to review the general plan for the first time, what would, and it looks at how many years, 10 years?
In general, yes. Okay.
What would surprise me most about what you're planning?
That's a great question, and I think one thing that I hope will be a pleasant surprise for the community, our general plan is well over 300 pages right now, and this general plan, we're working to be really succinct and direct, that's easily digestible and something that we can effectively implement. I think that one thing that's been really interesting to learn, we've done a series of neighborhood open houses so that residents can weigh in on what the 2014 general plan recommendations were for their neighborhood and whether those still resonate or there are things that we should address. And we've had some really great discussions on some of the transitions of the neighborhoods where over the last 10 years, we've seen some pretty big shifts from neighborhoods that were really geared toward nightly rentals that have now become more of a full-time residence
moved in that
area.
Direction.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
I think some of those shifts, and also that we're getting close to being built out, and we'll have a lot of redevelopment and infill. But the 2014 general plan said we should really build an open space buffer around our community, and the city's been very successful in doing that.
And that actually leads to another interesting question, which at least interesting to me, which is, if I look at the 2014 plan, where was it most off, right? Where does reality most diverge?
So in the 2014 general plan, I think there were a few things that weren't quite on the radar, like Uber and Lyft and Airbnbs, and the way that technology is really changed the way that people move and experience the community. And that's one thing that we're working to address in this general plan, is that we're trying to anticipate ways that we can take advantage of how some of these developments in technology can help us.
Well, good luck with trying to anticipate what's going to happen in technology in the next 10 years. We're doing an interesting interview about that on Monday's Mountain Money, about how technology is expected to change things. Connor, everyone likes to rant about 248. How are you going to fix it?
So, as you're probably aware, 248's probably been studied over and over again for the past few decades, right? So, this is our sort of opportunity to look at it just from a transit perspective. I think a lot of the past studies have looked at it for primarily cars with a little bit of transit sprinkled in. That didn't go over very well. The council, both our city council and the county council, basically said we don't want to widen this just for cars. We don't want more cars coming in here. We don't want to build a bunch more parking just to accommodate for those cars. So what ended up happening is we're now looking at it through that transit lens. We've done a bunch of improvements between the bus running shoulder, some of the pedestrian tunnels along the corridor, enhanced stops, the new service going out to Richardson Flat. So there's been a lot going on, but I think this is really our opportunity to do something special there. About last year we kicked off the Recreate 248 transit study, and this is really seeking to do that enhanced premium transit along that corridor. You know, there's a lot of development going on out east, down south. The demand for 248 is only going to increase. So what we're looking to do is enhance that transit. We are sort of in the study phase of eliminating different alternatives. We started off with 12 different alternatives, which is a lot. There's been a lot discussed over the past few years. We want to make sure we captured everything. So we did sort of like an initial screening to make sure that those 12, you know, we wanted the best ones out of those. So we got it down to about three, depending on how you want to look at it. So we're going to be showcasing those three alternatives at the open house.
Recognizing that it's hard for listeners to visualize, can we try to paint in broad strokes what the three are?
Yeah, absolutely. So the three are going to be bus rapid transit, or BRT, and that would be dedicated bus lanes for those.
And that involves, like, I take it, you still would be widening the road, but you'd be widening the road for buses.
Yeah, and a lot of the widening's kind of been done already. There'll obviously be areas where we do need to widen probably significantly in order to accommodate a full bus lane. There's some different technology options that we're looking at. I think Flex Lanes is another one that we're looking at.
That was one I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah, we're actually I'm kind of excited to look at it a little bit, especially for the Bonanza section. Looking at flex lanes for transit as well for the dedicated bus, that way we don't need two lanes going
That's
in and out.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we're looking at a bunch of different things. Kind of exciting stuff. We're not sure how it would work. There's not really an example in the U.S. of that specific use case. I think there's one in New York, but it doesn't work the way that we're looking at trying to implement
it. And we said that specific use case,
yeah.
A reversible lane for transit only?
Yeah.
Because obviously there are lots of jurisdictions that have reversible lanes for commuter traffic.
Yes.
And is that, you know, I look at 248 and I wonder, is that something that, that you've looked at, and is that, would that be practical to implement?
It's been looked at. I think for this study specifically, we are doing that hyper-transit focus.
Right.
So we're not going to be implementing things like reversible flex lanes, or, you know, it's been talked about tolling and things like that. We're not looking at it through this study.
Okay.
We're just trying to enhance the transit on that corridor.
Is that one? Do we do two?
Sorry, we just did the one.
That's right, that's right.
So the other two, one we're looking at light rail still, which is pretty exciting. I think there's a lot of movement for that one. And then the third one is AGT, which is sort of like automated guideway transit. So if you've ever been to an airport and you've taken some sort of tram or something like that, that's kind of what AGT is. It's not really used in the U.S. too much for transit, like public transit itself. I think the best example is probably monorail, like in Vegas or in Seattle. But it's mostly used in airports in the U.S. So it's something we're looking at.
It's a hybrid of light rail, I take it.
Yeah, the best way to look at it is like transit that kind of uses tires and like a guideway to move the vehicle.
And obviously for something like, for all of these models,
mm-hmm.
you have to have a kind of a field of dreams, attractive place for people to park, right? You have to build it so they'll come.
Yeah.
And where are you thinking about, I mean, isn't that the key to making all this work? I mean, I think the success of Richardson Flat
yes.
demonstrates that it can be done if you make it attractive enough.
Yes.
So what are you thinking about in terms of trying to make an attractive sort of place for people to do daily work commuters?
So it's funny you mentioned that. It's something we're working with our council right now to kind of flesh out. Right now for the East park and rides, we are still looking at Richardson Flat for enhancements, but we're also looking at the Gordo site as well.
Gordo's still on the table.
Okay. I can't say too much on it because that's going to be almost entirely up to our council to decide on what they want to move forward with on that.
Sure.
But it is something we are looking at.
And looking at amenities, I mean, I for one, I'm always saying you need to put a child care center at the park and ride so you can drop your kid and your car and get on the bus. I mean, that would work, but that's my personal soapbox, which they let me talk about from time to time. But anyway. Okay, so that's where we are. Linda, anything else on transit before we go? We've covered all three, right?
Yeah, we covered all three. The only thing else I'd mention is we're looking at two different alignments as well. So we're looking at 248 as the main corridor, but the council also wanted us to take a look at the rail trail.
I was going to say, if you were going to go light rail, wouldn't it have to be the rail trail?
There's complications with it, but if you would like some more information on it, come out to the open house on Tuesday.
So you're going to be able to talk about that. Okay.
Yeah.
Linda, I'm trying to make sure that we cover everything. What I know we want to talk about the Aquatic Center.
Yeah, actually, we have a couple of other spotlight projects at the open house on Tuesday. So the Recreation Department will be there to talk about the Mark Aquatic renovations, which are underway and scheduled to wrap up by summer of 2026. And then we also have our engineering team there to talk about the Homestake Road infrastructure improvements. And that is a multi-use path, sidewalk, and some parking enhancements. And that got underway this week. So please plan to join us Tuesday, 5:00, Park City Library, and we'll have some additional, I believe general plan staying open until about 8:00. So come on by. It's a drop-in format for all of our projects.
So it's not you're not going to be doing a formal presentation. You're just going to be there so people can ask you questions and sort of interact.
Yes, and we'll have the draft recommendations for the community to review.
How many people, do you remember how many people showed up last year?
Oh.
Because I was there.
It's really varied. Yeah. It, you know, obviously depends. I think last year we had snow for our spring open house, so that made things a little tricky. But typically
Linda,
we have 100 or so.
Don't do that again.
I know. No snow. But we have 20 projects that we're showcasing. This is the biggest one that we've ever done, and really encourage the community to come out and learn more about the city.
And before we go, one more time, can you explain about the bike check?
Oh, yeah. We've got our transportation planning team along with our trail rangers that are offering a spring bike check for kids. So if you've got some kiddos, bring their bikes out and we'll make sure they're ready for spring and summer riding.
Okay. We've been talking to Linda Jager, Rebecca Ward, and Connor Campobasso. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks.
Once again, Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. We'll be right back after this. Well, some new messaging about underage drinking is about to appear at the Wasatch Aquatic Center. Here to tell us about it, we have Trudy Bremerton with Wasatch Behavioral Health and Carla Nava with Wasatch Calves. Have I got that right?
Yes.
Good morning, and thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
So, yes. Carla, I think you might be the right person to ask this question. How did this messaging campaign come about?
So we actually had the opportunity. Luke Searle brought this project into CAPS, which is the Center for Advanced Professionals. And we had the opportunity to look over at a SHARP survey from 2023. And we saw and realized that over half of parents with sixth graders living in Wasatch County do not communicate expectations of no alcohol use at least twice a year.
Okay. And what is the SHARP survey?
The SHARP survey is a survey that is based on Utah students.
Okay.
Yeah, I can give a little more explanation. It's a survey done statewide, and it's done every 2 years in 6th, 8th, 10th, and 12th grades. And it's so great because we get, like, specific data to our school district. And so we can really look at what all the issues are and the things that are concerning, the things we're doing great in. And so it's really valuable information.
So obviously this issue of communication with kids about underage drinking leapt out to somebody from this survey. And so how do CAPS projects like this work?
So, like I previously said, Luke Searle brought the project into CAPS. It's a new thing that we've had the opportunity to work on. I am currently working on the CAPS project with Naomi Hobby and Kaysen Ashworth. So there's multiple fields in CAPS, and I'm part of the health. Kaysen is digital design, and Naomi is business and marketing. So we were put on this project, and we kind of work based off of the fields that we're in. So we just had to talked with Trudy and Andrea about the project and see what way we wanted to head towards to come up with this idea.
Okay, so Trudy, how big a problem is underage drinking in Wasatch County?
Yeah, so when we look at our SHARPS data, over the years, we're always in about the 20 to 25% of students who have tried alcohol at least once in their lifetime. And so that's a fairly concerning statistic, you know, that almost a quarter of our students are experimenting with alcohol. And it falls into the same realm as vaping. We're about the same place with vaping. And so really, what we've learned from our data and research is that parents have a huge influence on their kids. Like, mm-hmm. lots of times as parents, we think our kids don't listen to us, but really parents are the number one influence. And so if parents set those clear expectations about how they feel about alcohol and drug and tobacco use, it does make a big difference in their children's outcome.
And that 25% figure, how does that compare nationally?
Utah, we're lucky. We're fortunate that we always do a little bit better than national statistics, mm-hmm. so we're fortunate about that. And we find that in Wasatch County, we're about the same as the state rate for Utah, pretty close, give or take.
Okay, so I think we've identified the problem, which is, from your perspective, lack of communication. What are you gonna do about a solution? How did you formulate an approach, and what is it?
Yeah, so through this specific campaign, we chose to put messaging up at our Wasatch Aquatic Center, where lots of families, students, children visit. It's also our competition pool for Wasatch High School, so we have people who come from all over the state. And so it's just a great place for messaging. And we have, you know, our pool has big window areas, and so we've placed messaging on those windows. They're very visible spots. In both the activity pool, which is more the play pool for the kids, and then in the competition pool, too. So lots of messaging. And Carla can kind of tell you what some of that messaging is that we put up.
I'd like to hear that, but first I have to ask, did you paint anything on the bottom of the pool?
No, we didn't. But I wish you would have been here to tell us about that. It's a great idea. We work with R&R Partners out of Salt Lake, and they are a phenomenal creative team. And they come in and, you know, kind of decide where the great places for the messaging are and what works well. And so we will keep that in mind for a future project. I'm sure they'd gladly empty the pool for us.
They probably would. And it would get a lot of attention. So tell us about some of the messages.
So some of the messagings are, again, based on the SHARP survey, and some of them go along the lines, parents, it's important to keep a bird's eye view. 2 out of 3 youth who drink alcohol before the age of 15 go on to use illegal drugs. Be clear about your rules, no drinking alcohol underage. And then one of the main ones that we have is actually be a parent first and a friend second. Mm-hmm. Something very important, I think, and
That's a real issue because a lot of parents want to sort of think about their own experience and think, well, you know, I did these things, and that's not always being a parent first, right? And so I think that's a really important message. Trudy, do you find that's hard to get parents to sort of grapple with that?
I think a lot of times it's hard to. It's hard to get the message out to parents. That's right. The biggest thing. Like, we know what the research is and what we need to educate parents about, but reaching them is hard. And parents are kind of confused. Like, we do tend to think, I did it. I was in high school or back when I was young, but things are different now. And one of the biggest things is we are able to do brain research. Right. We know how alcohol and drug use affects a teen's developing brain, and it has huge effects on it. And so, like when I was growing up, that wasn't information that we had. So it's just really important now that we are able to get that information out.
Okay, so grand opening, grand unveiling in the next couple days. Tell us, Carla, tell us some of the events that are going to surround the kickoff here.
So our kickoff will be on Saturday, May 10th, from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. We'll be having food trucks there and games. And then we're also hoping to do like a tour where people can walk through and look at the messaging. And then we'll have 1 hour, $1 swim day as well.
Oh, okay. So people can access the pool. And what time do these events take place? And I understand you're going to have some VIP celebrity guests there as well. Is that right?
Yes, we will. Actually, today we have May 9th, we have our ribbon cutting ceremony and press conference. So we'll have like the school board there, like the Wasatch County School Board, and then state officials there, and just anybody that's welcome and willing to come support us.
Okay, so this afternoon's the ribbon cutting. The other events are tomorrow. Anything else you want to talk about with respect to the opening?
I think something that's kind of unique to the project is the CAP students did a community survey and to ask what they wanted our messaging to look like. And because when you think of a pool, you kind of think of an ocean scene, and some other aquatic centers around the state have used that. And we propose the option of if you want a mountain scene or a ocean scene, and the community came back and said, we like the mountain scene. Mm. And so we put in cute little messaging about otters, and our current mascot at our high school is the wasp, and then when we get our new high school, it'll be the river hawk. So we kind of have a wasp's nest in one of the messaging graphics, and then we have some ospreys, river hawks flying around. So we kind of tried to incorporate that as well. And so it's just really cute messaging that draws people into it because they look at the graphics, read the messaging, and I think it's a great educational.
It sounds like it's a lot of time and energy went into the quality of the graphics and trying to make these messages pop a little bit. Is there any way, is any of that visible on a website for our listeners who aren't going to make it into the pool tomorrow?
Not yet, but we're hoping that we'll put some up on our websites and see if we can do that.
So, my producer, Bill, is saying, why don't you ask who the artists were?
Yeah.
Thanks, Bill.
So, Carla, you talk about Kaysen and kind of how you guys did the mood boards?
Yeah, definitely. So R&R actually asked Kaysen to create some mood boards that they could go based off. And so Kaysen Ashworth, he goes over digital design and the caps. He created, I think, a couple mood boards that R&R went off based off. He looked at a lot of sharp statistics that we pulled out, and that's how we came up with this theme. And then also the survey that we involved the community in, we thought it was really important to include them as well.
So while I have you, what else is on the drawing board for CAPS this year that you might want to share with our audience?
That's a tricky question. There's a lot going on in CAPS currently. We hope to have more students join the CAPS program. I mean, especially in health. I think there's at least 6 students in my class. Mm-hmm. And we really want students to get into CAPS so they can learn more about the pathway that they're wanting to take and learn if that's something if they're willing to take and stuff. It's kind of like a push where it's a class where you push yourself. And I think it just really gives you that life experience, that world experience, right? And it helps you prepare for the real world.
And Trudy, are there other projects that you're looking at in terms of communicating with youth, other communication projects like this on your drawing board?
Yeah, so I'm the prevention coordinator with Wasatch Behavioral Health. So that's a big part of my job, is just getting that messaging out to the community. So we do several things throughout the year. On June 19th at our Heber Market on Main event, we're sponsoring a Celebrating Mental Health Night where we'll talk about, you know, things to do, the 5 senses to kind of help with mental health. Our coalition, the Caring Community Coalition, sponsors every year Family Dinner in the Park. And again, that's a huge opportunity where the parents empowered messaging, having bonding with your children, monitoring your children, setting firm boundaries with your children is really promoted at that event. But it also brings the whole community to it as a connected community. And we have sponsors and offer meals to people, so it kind of serves maybe some people that have food insecurity as well. But mostly it's just a community gathering event and a place where we can encourage family dinner as a way to bond with your family and build those good communication avenues.
Okay, before we go, once again, what time is the event tomorrow if people want to come and do the dollar swim and see what's going on?
It's from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., and we hope everybody's there. Also, for students, you can make up to 2 UAs if you bring a parent with you.
Well, there you go. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much.
We'll be right back after this. Summit County is pulling some funding from Sundance after it announced plans to leave Park City for Colorado. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the Institute applied for a grant to market its final festival in Utah.
The Summit County Council approved a committee's recommendation for divvying up $4.37 million in restaurant sales tax money May 7th, except when it came to the Sundance Institute.
If this is the swan song, I'm not sure that reinvesting the money at this point in that particular entity is maybe the right way to go. And I'd just like to know what council thinks about that.
Council member Roger Armstrong's colleagues agreed. The Sundance Film Festival is leaving Park City after 2026 for Boulder, Colorado. Sundance had asked for $225,000, the usual amount it wants to market the festival. The Restaurant Tax Committee recommended $85,000, less than half of what they awarded the event last year. The council told the committee to select another organization or organizations to receive the money instead. Here's Councilmember Candace Hart.
But if it's just being used to advertise in the Wasatch Front for an organization that's leaving the Wasatch, I'd rather take that money and invest it into a local organization that is committed to helping the people in our community.
Council Chair Tanya Hansen also noted that after Sundance missed a separate grant deadline last year, the council made a special exception to give them $130,000 anyway.
And so I think with that in mind, with them leaving and with the promotion along the Wasatch Front, I'm in agreement.
The Restaurant Tax Committee will reconvene and decide how to reappropriate the $85,000. Although it had $4.37 million to give this year, organizations asked the committee for a total of $7 million. And Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW, which is among the organizations awarded a restaurant tax grant this year. The station will receive $4,000 for its Skate Your Groove Thing, a free community event. A full list of the awarded grants is at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The Utah Department of Transportation will begin striping new lanes on state roads, including those in the Wasatch Back. As part of the largest striping project in state history, UDOT will replace lane markings on portions of freeways with wider lanes. The contrast striping, also known as tiger tail striping, lays down a white line followed by a black line to make lanes easier to see. It also helps autonomous vehicle sensors and cameras recognize the lines. In 2024, UDOT added new contrast striping to more than 6 million feet of road in Utah, Salt Lake, Davis, and Tooele counties. This year, the focus is on interstates, state routes, and major corridors in Tooele, Davis, Salt Lake, Wasatch, Summit, and Utah counties. That includes US 40 through Park City and Heber City, and Interstate 80 from Park City to Colville. Construction schedules are weather-dependent and subject to change. For the latest construction traffic, visit the UDOT traffic website. Stay tuned after the NPR News Community Campfire, special Mother's Day edition. We're going to explore the lives of six mothers from the Wasatch Back. And of course, we're going to have Coach Skinner with the skinny on local sports and some laughs with the Campfire kids.